Okay, let's call to order the special meeting of the Story County Board of Adjustments for August 14th, 2014. Could we have a roll call, please?
Miller?
Here.
McGill?
Here.
Scarlett?
Here.
Gilmar?
Here.
Excellent. Well, we appreciate everybody showing up today. At the middle part of the day, we appreciate it very much. Everyone should have received an agenda or was able to get one online. Do we have any other revisions or changes to those agenda to note at this point? Okay, hearing none, then that will stand approved as it was submitted. We did have two sets of meetings that had minutes out there that we had not yet approved. One was for July 2nd, 2014, and then the other one was for the abbreviated meeting of August 6, 2014. Do we have any revisions or corrections to either of those sets of minutes?
I move that we approve the minutes from the July 2nd and August 6th meeting.
Second. Got a motion and a second to approve the minutes of July 2nd and August 6th. All in favor indicate aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Do we have anyone that would like to speak on general comments from the public other than from the cases of today? Okay. So then we will move right on to, now on the vetter, was that formally put on the table? I've got to try to remember.
Yes, yes.
So then that really is old business.
Yes.
We should start with the vetter, and the first thing I'd ask for is a motion to take that off of the table.
So move.
Second.
The motion and a second to take the vetter variance VAR 04-14 off of the table. All in favor indicate aye.
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 Opposed? Okay. So then we will open up, and I would suggest that this has been, I'd like to probably go through this rather than just exactly where we stopped, but in perhaps an abbreviated fashion, and if staff would let us know through a normal staff report process what, if anything, has changed since the last time.
Sure. And the applicant did submit a little packet here of additional information. With that information, I'm going to defer most of that onto the applicant to speak on behalf of it. But just going through some of the changes that we're possibly looking at from last month. First of all, this is a variance request of Section 89.023D1. To exceed the maximum cumulative area of external signs of 300 square feet, and another section to also exceed the maximum height of 20 feet. I believe at your last meeting, and I'm just going to kind of go through some of these pictures. If you want to see any of them again, let me know, but if not, I'm just going to go quickly through them. Your last meeting, the request for the total height of the sign, I believe, was 30 feet tall and had a total cumulative sign area of 360 square feet. Since that and the new materials that the applicant has submitted, they have reduced that request, I believe, and you'll want to get that on the record formally from the applicant. But my understanding is that request, one of the proposals has been reduced to 25 feet in height and then 300 square feet in total square footage, so a reduction of 60 square foot total and a reduction of 5 feet on height. However, our zoning regulations, again, only allow for 300 square feet total. That one sign would take up all of that square footage, and as you'll recall, there was two additional signs that they'd be looking at to get in the future, plus two other wayfinding signs that they have on the property right now that would take that well over that 300 square feet total. So just kind of wanted to update, I guess, where we are on that. With that, I would entertain any questions you have with staff at this point, but would look for you to have the applicant present the rest of the information. Sure. With the new proposal, if that is what is being sought, the total square footage would be 368.4, so roughly 369, which would be 69 total square feet. And that is when the two new signs would also be placed on the property.
Well, then I have a question that's probably definitional in nature. We've got obviously, but I'm going to deal with the ones that are currently there and not the two future as we go. So we've got a main sign and we have two directional signs. And in going back to the definitions in the land regs and looking through that, other than the fact that the wayfinding has the better name at the top, if that better name was removed, does that necessarily then fall into the 300 square feet?
You're talking the sign that they're proposing or the wayfinding sign?
Well, as I look at the sign requirements, clearly you're trying to address that's an excellent picture. That's exactly the one. You're trying to address marketing. Okay? And my point is the two small signs on the side, other than the fact that they say better, if they didn't say better, would they count in the 300?
Yes, they would count. And we don't, you know, marketing is a component, I think, of our sign regulations, but the way our sign regulations read it, they're really not trying to judge the content of the sign, more just the structure of the sign itself and limiting the amount of structure that can be placed on for that purposes. You can get into case law and stuff like that and freedom of speech, showing that, you know, realistically it's hard for us to regulate the content that goes on signs, but if they meet our requirements as far as size and whatnot of the signs, that's where we'll really look into. So height of the sign and actual square footage. But we do, you know, from...
Basically saying we don't have a lot of latitude.
Yeah, when it comes to the content of the sign, yes. But that's, again, we're able to regulate the size of signs. When it comes, you know, we do exempt signs under a certain square footage. We do actually exempt from permitting requirements, meaning you don't have to come in to get a permit for them. And I'll look here to see exactly what that square footage is. However, I know our regulations do state, even though you don't need a permit, that total square footage of that sign still is counted
into the
cumulative.
Still goes into the 300 regardless.
Yeah, exactly. So these smaller signs right here never got a permit because it wasn't required to get a permit. However, you know, if they put up these things, I think are 10 square feet total. If they put up 30 of these, at that point it could become an issue because you're over that 30 or 300 square feet that's allowed.
That helps. I appreciate it. I just needed a clarification on those definitions. Anything else for staff? Okay. Have you received any additional comments since our last meeting?
No, we have not. Okay. And I would just note, and you'll notice that we did officially open the public forum portion of this at the last meeting, and there was nobody present to speak on it.
Okay.
And you'll see with your findings of facts, too, I did note that and just kind of what happened with the last meeting and what we did. So.
Okay, we would ask them that the applicant would please approach the podium and share with us what you would like today.
Good afternoon. I'm Gary Anderson. I'm a store manager at Better Equipment at the location that we're discussing here. In our last gathering, you requested that I provide you with some information with regard to documentation with regard to the sign requirements that the companies require that we do business with, one of those being Steel, the other one being Cub Cadet. I did get letterhead information provided to you with regard to the requirements for us to be able to stay in compliance with the sales and service agreements with both of those companies. Both of those companies are requiring us to provide them with a 4x8-foot sign. I do have an example here in my hand as to just about what the sign would look like. And so those are situations. One of them is on letterhead. The other one was from a Cub Cadet representative, and he was on territory at the time when I was trying to submit this, so I wasn't able to get it on his specific letterhead from Cub Cadet, but I was able to get it on Steel for their signage requirement for what we have to do to maintain our compliance with those contracted vendors. As you can see, our sign right here is another piece of information that I provided in that documentation also. What I find is basically a two-fold or a two-principled issue that we're dealing with here. One of them is our opportunity to stay in compliance with the vendors or the companies that we represent, that being Case IH, Cub Cadet, and Steel. As a contracted dealer and our sales and service agreement, we have to adhere to the guidelines with regard to our sales and service agreement for marketing, parts, service, signage, and all other things that we have to comply with in order to be able to retain their contract. We also have to provide satisfactory performance on a year-in, year-out basis with these contracted companies in order to retain that contract. So at any point in time, if we're not in compliance with the contract in any one of these factions or areas, we stand in non-compliance with the contract and we stand to lose the opportunity to do business with those companies. So that's first and foremost the principal issue that I'm contending here or requesting the variance for, because if at any point in time I fall out of compliance with our contracted companies, I stand the chance of losing the ability to do business with that company, and it will impact my business. The other point that I'd like to bring forward is the fact that it's nobody's fault when we purchase the ground that we're residing on right now. We set at highway grade below, or excuse me, we set below highway grade at highway 30 to the tune of about 5 to 6 feet. In order to be fair and equitable for us to be able to market our products and show our put our best foot forward with regard to the business that we do, we are requesting a variance in order to be able to stand above or at least at highway grade level. That's why we requested originally to go with the 30-foot sign. In that, we went back to Case IH, our principal supplier, and requested that they give us a little bit of leeway with regard to our signage requirement for the size of business that we have. And they, in fact, said that they understood the situation and would try to work with us in order to be able to bring this into a reasonable situation for all to be able to comply with. So they reduced the signage requirement that we had at 30 feet down to 25 feet. I also provided you, and I think I'm going to do some paraphrasing with regard to some of the notes, but the one, the most important note that I bring forward is the two proposals that I put forth in the information that I provided you. The first proposal was a 30-foot sign, a 30-by-12 sign, and the 30-by-12 sign, as you can see in my proposal, is 360 square feet. The Cub Cadet sign, in order to retain compliance with their requirements, is a 4-by-6-foot sign, which would be 24 square feet. The Steel sign would be a 4-by-6-foot sign, again, at 24 square feet. And then the two small entry signs are the ones that we were discussing here that's up on the board here that are our entry signs with regard to that. And there are two of those, and they would represent about 20.4 square feet. That all being said, we would come in at about a grand total of 428.4 square feet, which would equate to about 128.4 square feet over the limit set forth in the ordinance of 300 square feet. We also understand that the signage requirement is a 20-foot in height requirement, but we, like I said, I've gotten Case IH to relent and back off and give us the opportunity to go ahead and put up a 25-foot sign. Just for conversation's sake, I'm sure you've seen the tape that I put on the floor here. If you take the entire overage of 128.4 square feet and you equate it out to putting it into a realistic term, if you look at the tape marks, you may have to stand up to look at it if you don't mind, but look at the four tape marks on the outside perimeter, and that would equate over a quarter of a square mile the entire surface of what the overage would be for all signs inclusive. That is it. I can put it right here before you in simple terms. That's not an exact replication, but it's fairly close. In Proposal 2, we have reduced the signage requirement, or the signage situation, down to 25 square feet for the Case IH sign, or excuse me, a 25-foot sign. That would be, again, down to 300 square feet. That would comply with the ordinance. And with that, it wouldn't give us the ability to fall into compliance with the regulations or the situation for both Steel and Cub Cadet. And then also that would throw out the two entry signs that we'd have available in order to be able to do business and show our customers where to go on our property. taking that into account, that equates out to a grand total of 368.4 square feet, or a total mass of 8.5 by 8.0 square feet. Again, on the floor before you, I have on the inner scale equated that down to the total square footage of 68.4 square feet on the floor before you to show you somewhat how minuscule this would be spread over the entire span of the Cub Cadet sign, the field sign, and the two small entry signs if we are in compliance with the 300 square feet on the KSI-8 sign. The important thing that you have to remember about all of this is I have to stay in compliance with the contracts that we support. That's where this issue is with regard to trying to meet your standard and also trying to meet the standard and be in compliance with the contracts that we support. That's where the crux of this situation really lies. We have tried to take a look at various other opportunities that are available to us in that possibly rather than having a 25-foot sign and bring it down to 20 feet and berming up the area in our display space on our lot to where we would have to raise that 5 to 6 feet in grade in order to be able to maintain grade level with regard to Highway 30. That being said, that would be probably somewhere between 25 and 50 feet in total circumference in order to build it up to where you could either mow it or take care of it or maintain it or anything like that. And if that was the case, that would eliminate about probably anywhere from 15 to 20% of our display space for us to be able to display combines and tractors and other products that we market and try to sell. In addition to that, I am very concerned about the fact that if we do berm up that space, we would be presenting an issue where if we get the heavy rains that we have a tendency to get on at times, with the drainage situation going from east to west, we would probably create an atmosphere of ponding in that area, and then again, part of that land in front of our business is also in the DOT realm, so I don't know that it would be smart on our part to flood their land, so to speak. So from that standpoint, berming just does not represent a situation where it, in my opinion, would be anywhere near reasonable. Suggesting to remove the lower panels of the KSI-H sign. The thing that's really unique about the sign is that if you look at the face of the sign, the bottom two panels don't really carry any weight with regard to advertising or promotion or anything else. They're nothing more than blank panels. If we took out the bottom panels of that sign, it would be, in my opinion, as I referenced in here, it would be like going to a McDonald's and telling them to take down one of their golden arches. It just doesn't make sense. The company markets their products. And the other side of it, too, I don't think the company would even allow us to do that from that standpoint. To hang other signs on the KSI sign or to hang other signs on either one of the other vendor signs is an absolute taboo. We cannot do that by contractual situation. So I cannot hang a Cub Cadet sign on this sign. I cannot hang this sign on a Cub Cadet sign. That's just outside our contractual boundaries in order to be able to do that. So I guess really what it boils down to is we, as a business, we have to do everything we can to market our products to our consuming public. And we're not like a Casey's or a Tyson's or any other store or business out there, a Chevrolet dealer, because we don't cater to the general public. We cater to a very limited marketing opportunity with regard to farmers. There are not many farmers anymore. The farmers are bigger, but they're fewer. And so we have to do everything we can in order to try to promote our business and try to garner that business the best way we can. And the only way we can do that is either through print media, through any other source of advertising that we have available to us, be it signage, TV, radio, or whatever medium that would be out there. So from that standpoint, it just makes it tough for us to be able to try to go out and get the business. I do have a few other notes here, and I think it's really prudent to bring it forward. It's not in the information that you have, but bottom line, it goes back to the fact in 2001, Better Equipment purchased a struggling dealer in the city of Nevada. We rented the building in the city of Nevada, and since then, we've done everything we can to promote and grow the business. When we started this business in 2001, we employed 14 people. since then, we've been able to grow the business to the point to where we needed additional space, and Glenn Vetter, the owner of the business in 2006, purchased 50 acres of ground with the opportunity and the dream of bringing this business forward and growing it in the community where they thought they could reside and do well. So the dream came true in 2011 with the opportunity for us to expand the business and the opportunity to put up a 63,000 square foot building on 50 acres. Now we employ 28 people. We've doubled the size of our business employee. That represents 28 families that are doing business in the city of Nevada, in the community of Story County and Ames also. From that standpoint, it is a situation where we have to do everything we can to make sure that these employees and everybody are taken care of. We pay our taxes. Our tax bill for the county of Story is $140,000 a year. Now, as a small business, and I don't know if you're a small business people or not, I have no clue, but the relevance here is the fact that it costs us $383 per day, 365 days a year, to turn the key in the door to walk through it. So somehow, some way, I have to do everything I can in order to market this business in order for us to be able to survive. Now, with the situation as it is right now, Vetter equipment is being pinched. We're being pinched by the county of Story, because you have your ordinances that you have to abide by. We as Vetter Equipment are being pinched by our suppliers in the fact that in order to stay in compliance with the contractual obligations that we had with them, we had to fall within the reasonable line of the signage that they throw to us. So from that standpoint, it creates an atmosphere where our hands are tied, for the most part, in order to try to be able to survive and grow our business. A couple of other things that really, really kind of stick in our crawl is through this timeline, from the time we started putting this building up, we have met at every turn with resistance from the county of Story, the city of Nevada, and the city of Ames with regard to trying to get this building up. First off, the first thing that we ran into is we greatly wanted the opportunity to have city water and city sewer. We met with both the city of Nevada, we met with and also with the city of Ames, and they were absolutely not interested to bring us sewer and water. So then we had to go to Plan B. Plan B was to go to Central Iowa Rural Water. Central Iowa Rural Water came to us and said, glad to help you out. It's going to cost you an acre of ground because we want to put up a water tower because this is deemed as a potential industrial area, and for the future, in order to be able to supply it with water, we need some place to put a water tower. And we thought through with it a little bit, but then again, when we got down to the fine line, they wanted not only the acre of ground that we would have to donate, they wanted the choice of anywhere on our property to where they could put it. Oh, and by the way, they wanted an $80,000 fee in order to be able to get it.
I need to just slow you down at least, if not stop you at this point in time. Do you understand the role of the Board of Adjustments?
Yes, I do.
Okay, so you understand that we're not economic development.
I understand that.
About jobs. We don't issue licenses. We don't negotiate utilities or other stuff. I mean, our only aspect is the land development rights.
I completely understand
so
that.
So the things that you have eloquently shared with us, you know, in the last however much time that it took, do you understand that all of that is irrelevant?
I understand it's irrelevant.
I'm not saying it's not relevant to you. I'm not saying it's not relevant to Story County or to some other people. But I just want you to understand that by going through all of that, it's affected what we have in front of us zero. And I just don't want to have you have false hopes that somehow you have all these things that you want to bring up and that this particular board has the authority to reverse any of that.
I completely and totally understand that.
Okay, then could I ask you to stay a little closer to what we can deal with?
The only reason I brought these things up is because I have come upon deaf ear for the last 3 years, and I would hope that not only this board, after this meeting, would go back and take a look in the mirror and see how we all represent Story County and the cities of Nevada and Ames. All too often, we get locked into situations where we become small and we get comfortable with small and we don't look outside the box. All I'm asking this board to do is look outside the box and take a look at the growth opportunities that are available for this community and the future.
We're not in growth. And And I'm sorry to be redundant like that, but this particular board has a very limited charge. And we are not given a lot of latitude in that regard. And I'm not saying that you shouldn't be sitting down with the Board of Supervisors or anybody else to deal with the issues that you have. But our charge is very narrow. The criteria that we are allowed to consider are very few. And I mean, that's just the reality of where we're at.
I don't disagree, but my charge is very narrow, too. My charge is the fact that we've requested a variance. We, as a company, are pinched between you and the companies that we supply. The companies that we supply have given us the guidelines. Case IH has come back and given us the opportunity to downsize the size of the sign in order to be able to work this thing out. All we're doing now is asking you as a board to give some form of latitude with regard to this issue and help us out. And if you do help us out, you'll be the first in this county to do so in the subject.
I have one question in the letter that came here from Steele that was in here. I don't see anything in here that says that they can't have a sign mounted on the wall. Nothing in this particular communication from Steele, anyhow. It says they recommend an outdoor illuminated, but I don't see anything in here that says they couldn't have a sign on the wall.
They will let you have, both companies will let you have a sign on the wall. But you also have to understand, by putting a sign on the wall, we've got a brand new building there, and you're putting screw holes into a brand new building. You stand the potential for leaking. You stand the potential for leaching of grust and things that go down the side of your building. Also with Case IH, we will have a fascia that is going to have to be put on our building down the road with regard to a banner with our Case IH name and the veteran name that will be striping along the top part of our building and the front of the building. The other side with regard to putting signage on the building, you also have to think about that from a common sense standpoint in that most of the traffic that goes east and west on Highway 30 are coming along at about 60 to 65 miles an hour, and to have the signage attached and affixed to the building will either create a situation where it's an unsafe situation if somebody's trying to find out and look who and where we are, or number two is the situation where they will just completely pass and not even see the sign and miss the building and the business completely.
But earlier, as part of your presentation, I understood that it was said that Steele said you had to have that sign. And I'm just saying, out of what you presented here, I don't see anything that says that you have to have a freestanding sign.
Both companies, as I said, require a 4x6 foot sign.
Correct.
And in our instance, the 4x6 foot sign just doesn't work attached to the building.
I think I understand the answer, even though I didn't get it from you. I had to infer. I mean, all I asked was whether the Steele allowed, because what you submitted indicated that it doesn't say that it can't be a building mounted sign.
I don't know if I supply this or not, but I will submit it to you now if you'd like.
I believe we have it as part of the package. We've got the sign and the letter.
No, there is.
Yeah, we have that.
At the bottom, on the left-hand corner, it says a 4x6 outdoor illuminated sign, 4x6.
Right.
And if you look to the left, if you look
to... recommend that you order this sign, but it never says that you've got to have a freestanding sign?
It says to the right of that, pole mounted.
I agree.
So that, in my, if you want to infer something, that infers to me that it has to be a pole-mounted sign.
Okay. Well, it doesn't say that their requirements, I don't see anything that says that there's a requirement that has to be that way. I don't see anything that says that it can't be wall-mounted.
To me, it's clear right here that it has to be a pole-mounted sign. It says it right here.
Any other questions for the applicant?
I understand. I don't mean to belabor the point, but why do you think that it has to be a pole-mounted sign? I want to understand what your position is on this particular little form where it says new dealer sign program. What about this makes you think that it has to be pole mounted?
Two principal reasons. Building mount sign on our building would create an atmosphere of potential leaking on our building. It will also precipitate an opportunity for whatever you do use or utilize to attach the sign to the building would rust, and the rust would leak down the side of the building and become an eyesore.
Just to make sure that I'm clear, the steel's not saying we're concerned about compromising your building, right? I mean, that's, in your mind, that's what makes sense. Is that
accurate?
Yes, ma'am. Okay. And is there any other, I mean, are you basing that opinion that steel's requiring you to do that on anything else based on what you've got here?
All I'm basing, and the other point that I want to make to back up to your first question is that it's a safety factor, I think, too, with the traffic that's traveling up to and from Ames and Nevada. If they're looking for our building and they're doing the turn, they won't see it until they get completely right up on the front of our building. And if somebody's slowing down or speeding up in order to make the turn into our facility, then there the opportunity arises for a potential accident. So those are the two principal reasons. As far as steel saying specifically, I have to have a pole sign, no, I'll admit to that. But the other side of it, I'm trying to approach this from a sensible point in that it's going to cost me money in the long run because I have to make sure that the sign doesn't leak down the sides of my wall and it defaces the rest of my building. And then item two is, in my opinion, it's a safety factor from the standpoint of the traffic that's going to and from me. Mm-hmm.
What's the drop from Highway 30 to your property?
The estimate, and Charlie and I talked about that, I think we're in the neighborhood of 5 to 6 feet.
Okay, so that 4 to 4 by 6 sign would be visible, but it would probably be best seen on the westbound side of Highway 30, right? Thinking about the steel sign and the other one?
Most likely, yes.
Okay.
Right. And the only variance part of this whole equation is just the Case IH sign. That's our principal supplier, and I think that's the one we want to make sure that we get up and where we get it to the point where we're at highway grade so that we can do what we want to do. The other two signs will still maintain the lower grade level. I'm not asking for that.
Anything else? Okay. I assume we don't have any other comments from the public as such. Any last statements?
All I'm doing is trying to do business. We're trying to stay within the boundaries of your obligations and my contractual obligations to the company. As I said earlier, we're caught in the middle on this. I'm trying to do the prudent thing. I'm trying to have people kind of look outside the box. Case IH has looked outside the box and is backed up on their requirement. All I'm doing is asking the board to have some compassion about this situation, the issue, and give us some grant the variance in order to be able to go on with business and do things that are a lot more important than what this is.
Thank you. Appreciate it. We will now close the case of VAR 04-14 for purposes of deliberation. And move on, first of all, to the findings of fact. I believe these are the same findings of fact with the exception that item 11 was added, which noted the meeting that we had on the 6th. Do we have any questions or comments on the findings of fact?
Move to adopt the findings of fact and staff report prepared for and presented to the Story County Board of Adjustment.
Second.
Okay, we have a motion and a second to adopt the findings of fact in the staff report prepared for and presented to the Story County Board of Adjustments. Roll, please.
Gill.
Aye.
Miller.
Aye.
Scarlett.
Aye.
Spielmeyer.
You may sit down. At this point in time, if the board has any additional questions, we will request that you come up. Thank you. Now we come down to working on the decision. And essentially, what we have got to come up with is in order to grant a variance, we have to find that there is indeed an unnecessary hardship. And there are three questions in there: that the land in question cannot yield a reasonable return if used only for a purpose allowed in that zone, that the plight of the owner is due to unique circumstances and not due to the general conditions in the neighborhood, that the use be authorized by the variance will not alter the essential character of the locality. B is granting the variance will not be contrary to the public interest. And C, the spirit and intent of the Story County Development Plan and the Story County Land Development Regulations are protected. The one that usually causes the trouble is A1, which basically says if we don't put up this sign, they're broke. That's the bottom line.
The problem I'm wrestling with is these regulations are not new. They've been in existence for quite a while. And obviously other issues you've wrestled with, but they were out there ahead of the business. So building the business, and I've built businesses, I've been around businesses. Why weren't these researched before the business was built or the property even purchased? I understand and I appreciate it, but that's the issue I'm wrestling with. The one I'm wrestling with is C.
I've dealt with marketing before, and the companies don't think about the individual community expectations. They design their signs, they design their materials, and they hand it out, and they say, if you want to be part of our company, this is what you have to do. And also, I'm sure that if we looked at Ames's signage, their requirements are different than what Story County's are, and that would be different than what Nevada's are. So I think sometimes we have to, like Gary said, look outside of the box and see if there isn't a way that we can make it work. So that's what I'm thinking. Because I dealt with that when I was at United Way. You know, United Way sends you this packet of materials and says, okay, you have to have a sign in your building. You have to try to make it fit.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Exception, something short of a variance that could apply here if the, I mean, what if we were talking about 1 square foot over? I mean, is there, you know what I mean? Is there any kind of, is there something less than a variance that potentially could, no?
Yeah, and simply put, no, even if it was 1 square foot over, we won't be able to permit it because from staff standpoint, what we have to look at is 300 square feet, anything above that, we have to say no unless there's some action by the Board of Adjustment that adjusts that regulation. So.
But for our board, the thing is we have to have good reason to make that exception. Now, part of my just observation, even in driving by today, as we deal with a little bit of what you're talking about in that neighborhood, we have other people out there that have been able to meet this and are going to presumably do business. And all of a sudden, I don't want to start something that says we get a sign war. My sign's bigger, taller, wider, brighter than your sign. Is that the neighborhood? Actually, the neighborhood has been defined by the Story County Land Development Regulations. That was the criteria for the neighborhood, which is kind of like Winstead. You know, this is, the neighborhood has been already defined. It wasn't defined by us, but it has been designed by regulations that have been approved. So there's my concern as one of the, as I drove down, I saw signs that met this criteria. They were able to. And I guess I can't, I have a hard time coming up with that these are extenuating circumstances when I see other people that are seemingly able to do that. So that's where my concern probably rests.
I thought your presentation was very well done, and I thought you made a very good case for yourself. I mean, you really did, and I would compliment you on that. And I understand, not just from your comments, but, you know, from your standpoint, it feels like you're caught up in this regulatory nightmare, right? I mean, Nevada, all these things. And I get and appreciate that. I know, you know, one thing, I appreciate Lynn's comments as well about marketing, but, you know, also, I also know that companies like that, I understand how they sign or how they send you these dealership agreements and require certain things of you. I get it. I mean, I get how the companies are squeezing you, you know, in your terms. But I also know that there are opportunities to revise those contracts. And, I mean, it's not my job to sit here and tell you how to conduct your business or, you know, where you should fight and where you shouldn't fight about various things. But part of me says, you know, it's unfortunate that at the time that you entered into some of these agreements with companies that there wasn't some provision put in your, you know, in your agreement that says that, yeah, you might have to have these types of signs, but you can't be forced to violate zoning regulations. You know what I mean? That there ought to be some sort of provision in your arrangement with the company that, that would protect you in that fashion.
So for our next steps, you know, just to remind on the procedures, we need to adopt a decision if we believe that the facts in the case that are written here are accurate and there's none that we want to add in there, then we would have to adopt that with the idea that after that adoption, now if there's an additional factor that we think needs to be added into the decision, we would add that at this point, but then the approval or denial comes at the next step after that. Anyone have any other comments regarding the decision, things that they feel need to be added, criteria that needs to be considered that is not there?
So in other words, our announcement of the decision means that if we actually approve or deny in the next in the ordinance, correct?
Yes. Essentially, through the application and the staff, they have attempted to outline for us the legal principles that apply and have given us comments in regard to those. If we think there's something that they've completely overlooked, or that we think needs to be, we're going to approve this decision along with the note that says, we note this, that's exactly what we would do. So this is moving us down the road, but this isn't the approval or denial at this stage. That's why I just wanted to kind of clarify that for the board and for...
Move to adopt the decision as outlined in the staff report prepared to present this regular board.
Okay, we've got a motion and a second to adopt the decision as outlined in the staff report prepared for and presented to the Story County Board of Adjustment. Roll, please.
Dale Meyer. McGill.
Aye.
Miller.
Aye.
Scarlett.
Aye.
So we have a set as such all the facts on the table, and it comes down to the point then of making a final motion to either approve or deny based upon everything in our knowledge today. I think we've all registered our concerns relative to the regulations. And I think we've also registered our empathy in regards to to the situation. I think it's been adequately noted that there are choices to be made, somewhat timely choices often that are there. So there's some unfortunate circumstances here without that. But are any of those enough to sway the board sufficiently to cause to override the regs?
I will add, I do have empathy for the situation that Mr. Anderson has caught in. I do realize I've worked with enough companies that you understand that, but I would have a tendency to agree with you. Other companies have made it work.
Well, I do have one thing that at the end of this, we have to deal with this as such, but I'm going to propose that we, at the end, regardless, frankly, of where we come off of this, we have before directed the board to put together a correspondence to the supervisors to consider a portion of the regs. And particularly what I would call at this time about, and it's probably definitionally not correct, the issue of the secondary signs that are on the left up there, I think that probably needs to, at some point in time, be addressed. You know, it's clearly not a storefront type sign, and I hate to see that be excluded from the 300-foot limit. And that would be the comment, is that we've run across a case there that deals with some directional signage that by the regs is currently being added into the total size signage, and that we would ask that they, at some point in time, reconsider that. That's all we could do is recommend and pull that to their attention, and it's up to them to take it from there. So I do have particular empathy for that. It's just that one doesn't seem to...
Right.
Because I'm not going to go down Highway 30 and be looking for those little signs that are off and around the corner and et cetera. And so it's hard for me to put that into that 300-foot cumulative number.
Well, and I would concur with that. Yeah. I mean, the only place you're going to see these small directional signs is on a big site like this, right? Yeah. I mean,
and you're going 15 miles an hour at the time.
No, that's a smart idea.
I intend on doing that regardless of where we end up, but... Not if I make a decision.
Okay, I'm going to do it. I move to approve the request as proposed by the applicant in case number VAR0414, as discussed by the Board of Adjustment and in the staff report prepared for and presented to the Story County Zoning Board of Adjustment, finding that all applicable legal principles have been satisfied.
Second motion.
Okay, we've got a motion to approve the request as proposed by the applicant in case number VAR04-14, as discussed by the Board of Adjustments, and if the staff report prepared for and presented to the Story County Zoning Board of Adjustments, finding that all legal principles have been satisfied.
Roll, please.
Scarlett?
Aye.
McGill?
Nay.
Fielmeyer? Miller?
Okay. So that concludes the VAR04-14. Unfortunately, it has been denied in this form, so we would encourage you to work with your suppliers, with your agreements, and see what you can do.
Thank you. Another banner day for Story County. I truly hope, not to record on it, as a matter, that we lose our contract. We go out there and really do a successful back to defend your property back according to you
We will accept responsibility for our decisions based upon our role, and that's it. Okay, we will go on now to CUP 08-14. Vinick? conditional use permit for Verizon Wireless.
As you had mentioned, this is a conditional use permit for a communications tower for Verizon Wireless. Proposed to be located on property owned by Lester and Ruth Schickel. Generally, looking at that property, it is located approximately 1/10 mile north of Onion Creek Lane and 1/10 mile east of North Dakota Avenue. The size of the property is just under 30 acres. However, the size of the leased area for the communications tower will be 75 feet by 75 feet. Current zoning in place on the property is A1 agriculture. Current land use, it is classified as agricultural for property assessment purposes, as it is currently being used as open space with some crop production ground located on it. This property does fall within the Ames Urban Fringe Plan, as it was within 2 miles of the city of Ames. The Fringe Plan does designate this property as urban residential. Map here will show you the property that we're looking at. Again, you've got North Dakota Avenue right here, Onion Creek Lane. Kind of zooming in on the property a little bit, the actual cell tower location is where that yellow dot is right there, if you can see that. This will be a conditional use permit, again, to construct a 120-foot tall monopole communication tower. There will be 12 proposed antennas and an 11.5 by 29.5 foot equipment shelter, all located within that 75 by 75 foot leased area. The tower will be erected, owned, and managed by SBA Towers V, LLC, and the equipment space will be sublet to Verizon Wireless. Communication towers and facilities are considered a conditional use in the A1 zoning district, subject to supplemental standards, which I'll go over, and all conditional use permits are approved slash denied by the Board of Adjustment after a recommendation by the Planning and Zoning Commission. So I want to go through and show you a few pictures to kind of give you an idea of what we're looking at here. This is actually taken from where the driveway entrance will be into the communications tower. Looking back again, 1/10 of a mile off this road is where it will be located.
That's North Dakota?
Yes, that's North Dakota right there. If you see it right down corresponding with these, I have arrows kind of showing exactly which direction the picture was taken from on the location. And this is North Dakota. Here's Onion Creek Lane. This one just kind of going a little bit more north and looking onto the actual property, the dwelling for the property owner right there. And you can see how those large mature trees kind of really separate where that tower is going to be from the view of the road. This looking from the corner of Onion Creek Lane and North Dakota Avenue, looking back over again to the general area where that tower will be. And again, you can see the large vegetation there that will help to buffer the use. This one's looking from about the end of Onion Creek Lane right here over onto the area. The cell tower actually will be located about right here in this area. This is about the only place where it's not visually screened from, where you probably will be able to see it pretty openly. But again, it is a good, probably from here, a good quarter mile away from where we're even standing. This just is going to go back up a little bit more north, up North Dakota Avenue, again, to show how those large trees there will help buffer. And this even going up a little bit further up to where I think it's the Iowa State. I don't know which farm they own up there. But from the entrance of that farm right there, again, looking over, cell tower will be located kind of in this area. And you can see, again, the trees really buffering the use. Won't go over the applicable regulations. I know we've done a lot of conditional use permits, and you should be well aware of what they are. The supplemental standards, however, for a communication tower, I will go over those. First of all, you have to prove that co-location opportunities have been exhausted, that separation from the plan and existing residential properties have taken place, that it does fall within the required height, the required setbacks, fencing and screening requirements have been met, that aesthetics have been met, compliance with other local and federal regulations, the obstruction of view, removal of abandoned towers and facilities, kind of a decommissioning plan, and other submittal requirements that are required with communication towers. Looking through all the materials that the applicant has submitted with this application, staff did note that there are no concerns of the proposed development's conformance to traffic, parking, loading, sign, lighting, and environmental protection. That's pretty standard with conditional use permits. We do want to point out that the board will need to determine the proposed development's conformance with the compatibility and transitional points of the approval standards. Most communication towers within the unincorporated area of Story County are located in the A1 zoning district, so this is not unique. However, this particular piece of ground is planned as a future residential use in the Ames Urban Fringe plan, and ground in which the City of Ames It's planned as future residential in the fringe plan, and that ground is classified as ground the City of Ames intends to annex by year 2030. Staff has visited the site and concluded that because of the large trees and the rolling terrain of this area, that there is a sufficient buffer between the proposed tower and North Dakota Avenue, as well as the existing residences within the immediate vicinity. The applicant has stated that as part of the initial search for a feasible site, the company, on behalf of Verizon Wireless, has looked for existing facilities for co-location opportunities. This is always an initial step in their site acquisition process. However, no existing facility meeting the needs of Verizon Wireless's network was found. The proposed wireless facility is considered a capacity site, which means that the existing network is already built and that the proposed tower will offload some of the demands on those surrounding sites. Looking back on that planned residential area, our regulations do read that all proposed towers are to be set back a minimum of 300 feet from neighboring properties either planned or utilized for residential purposes. This proposed tower is shown to be set back over 650 feet from the north line, over 1,000 feet from the east line, exactly 300 feet from the south line, however, 190 feet from the west property line. Staff did note that while the tower is not set back 300 feet from that west property line, the landowner who owns that parcel is the same person who owns the land that the parcel where the tower is going to be located. There's just a boundary line between them, as they're legally described as two separate parcels. Because of this, that the board needs to determine in their recommendation if property owned by the same owner is considered neighboring property. The 75-foot by 75-foot leased area is proposed to be enclosed by a 6-foot wood fence. That type of fence meets both the fencing requirements and screening requirements of our ordinance. The tower is also proposed to be constructed of galvanized metal, which will only have signage which is required by the FCC and only include a porch-type light, which will be located on the door of the equipment shelter. So it won't have one of those FAA warning lights on the top of it, usually strobe during the day, red at night, for most of them that we have. The applicant did not provide in its application materials any additional material regarding the site's ability to house future co-locations of other cell antennas. However, in phone conversations with the applicant and as well as the Planning and Zoning Commission, staff has been assured that this tower will be able to handle additional antennas. As usual, the application underwent review by the NRHC review team via email on June 16th. And public notice signs were posted on the site, notification letters were mailed to surrounding property owners, and legal notifications were published in the 3 official county newspapers. With that, the Story County Planning and Zoning Commission did hold a public hearing on the proposed conditional use permit and made the following recommendation. They recommended approval of the conditional use permit as put forth in CUP 0814 to the Board of Adjustment. Motions listed on the screen here above, there were no conditions assigned to that approval. And with that, your 4 alternatives are listed on the screen above me, and if there are any questions regarding the application, I'd be happy to answer them at this time.
I do have a couple of questions. The supplemental requirement on decommissioning. I mean, obviously, when we do CREX, we went to the point of having bombs and everything. I assume all
mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. Let me look at it real quick to get what the
is that just a note then that you end up putting on the conditional use permit that says that the applicant acknowledges?
Yeah, and more, we have power within our ordinance, I think, to show that, and I'm trying to get exactly what that date is. Well, here we go. If the use of the communication tower is abandoned, I think we have to give notice. That more or less says they have 90 days to remove it. If not, then we can take proper enforcement action on it. Yeah.
We haven't talked about one of these for a while.
Yeah.
And the second thing that we also haven't talked about maybe ever, I'd like to find out whether this board needs to consider, needs to totally not consider. I mean, what this whole thing about the fringe, okay? We've gotten close to this, but have never been there. Obviously, the existing parcel is 29.1, so it could not have houses put on it due to the county regs right now, so there can't be houses that are close to this. But if it comes, if it's part of the fringe and it's designated for that, I assume all of that goes to the wayside someday. And so this tower would become a legally existing non-conforming structure. Is that?
Yes, and the city of Ames did provide comment to that extent that more or less said that if it did not meet their regulations, they didn't review it to see if it met all of their regulations, but they were saying that if this land is ever annexed, it comes inside the city, and forever there's a certain component of that tower that does not meet the city's regulations, it would become a legally established non-conforming use.
But that's not a concern of this board. That's my main point.
While
the findings of fact say that, and I'm glad it did, because it points that out as an issue, that for purposes of deliberation, it's a moot point to us.
You don't have the power to adjust the advanced regulations for whatever reason, and you know that. But,
or should we take in future possibilities? I mean, the trouble that I have, I guess, is the regs say current or future.
Yeah.
In terms of some of the supplemental, so my question is, with the fringe thing, how are we supposed to take that or future?
One of the standards of approval deal with it says that if you've met all six of those standards of approval, the compatibility, transition, traffic, so on, if you get into that section B, if the board concludes that all of the above development criteria will be met, it must recommend approval or must approve for your situation unless, number five, not be in accord with the intent, purpose, and spirit of the land development regulations or the county development plan. The Ames Urban Fringe Plan does fall within the county development plan. It's a component of the county development plan.
That's part of what I was trying to get out as to what we should, you know, be blind to or what we needed to give further consideration to.
Okay. However, I will note, and I'm pretty sure this is how it is within the city of Ames, but even if it was brought in under a residential district, again, I can't speak for fact on this, but my assumption would be that the city of Ames would allow for cell towers depending, you know, in certain zoning districts. I don't know if they could, you know. Again, future land use is so unknown, you'll never know what happens with it, but there probably is ways to make it work.
We have them at the mall, we have them at the high square, it's not like they're not there. I just wanted to understand when we went through this what our obligation was to consider.
Okay, sure.
That answers mine. Other questions for staff? Anything we need? Okay. I'd ask the applicant to approach the podium. Identify yourself, please.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Mike Phoenix. I'm with LCC Law. Our office is at 10700 Higgins Road, Suite 240, Rosemont, Illinois. And I am here on behalf of SBA Communications, who is building the tower building the proposed tower for Verizon Wireless. It is a what's called a build-to-suit. Essentially, Verizon Wireless has gone to SBA Communications, who is a tower management / building company, and asked them to erect the tower for their network. So the way the process worked is Verizon Wireless and SBA issued our company a search area of approximately two-thirds of a mile, and we went out, looked for existing structures that we could potentially locate on. There were none that met the criteria for Verizon Wireless. Therefore, we approached the property owners here and worked with them to try and get a tower at that site. As staff eloquently mentioned, we are proposing a 120-foot monopole tower, and Verizon Wireless will co-locate on that tower at the top with 12 antennas, as well as their equipment shelter, all to be located within the 75 by 75 lease parcel. So One of the concerns that was mentioned was the potential for allowing for co-location. SBA Communications, as I mentioned, is in the business of leasing space to other carriers. So not only is it possible, it's highly encouraged. That's where they make their money, is to get others to locate on their towers. They are not in the business of providing cell coverage like Verizon is. So therefore, it's not only something that's potential, it would happen. In fact, they have master lease agreements with the other carriers throughout the industry, and essentially all you really have to do is go to them, say you want to get on that tower, and the agreements are put in place. You get the necessary approval from the local jurisdictions, and you can go on the tower in no time. So that is something that is definitely encouraged and would happen. As far as the issue of this site, as was mentioned, it is what's called a capacity site. It's a little bit different than a traditional coverage site. When the networks were first built out in the late 1990s, early 2000s, all you could do with a cell phone was make a telephone call. So the original network that was built out was built with the understanding, you know, with the capabilities to provide coverage for a cell call. However, back in around 2005, when the iPhone and all the Androids started to come into the market, iPads, all that type of equipment, the cell towers no longer could handle the amount of volume that's going through. So what Verizon is doing is going back into their grid, essentially, you know, it's like if you look at a die, number five, we're looking at putting one in the middle there. The four corners are already in place. The one in the middle is what we're doing with the capacity site. And essentially what it's doing is it's offloading the signal for those other sites so that it makes the network more robust all around. So it's essentially helping the other four sites as well, so they'll have better coverage as well.
Someone lives a half mile away and has two bars today, they'll still have two bars after this tower goes up. Is that?
No, it would probably increase the coverage for them, because by the one up in the northeast, let's say, if that one's struggling because it has a lot of capacity, you know, a lot of people using it, by putting this tower here, it's going to send some of that signal to offset some of those people that are...
Because you've offloaded the other towers and not because of the presence of this tower otherwise.
This tower will handle some capacity as well, but the main purpose is to get... They all work in conjunction with one another. A cell tower does not function in and of itself. If we had just one cell tower out here, that wouldn't be a good enough network. The only people that would be getting the signal would be within a mile or two of the tower. So they all work together, and that's where the capacity comes, or the capacity comes in. It helps those other towers to meet that capacity needs. Are there any questions at this point?
Actually, if this is approved, when would this be constructed?
As soon as possible. We would have to get the permits through the county. We've already submitted that application. Obviously, it can't be, you know, issued until you've decided, but we have submitted that application, and the lease agreement's already in place with the Schickels, so we're pretty much looking to get going right away.
Closed now, so... Every road's closed right now. Okay. Yeah, I'm just going down on drive line. Questions for the applicant? This is a pretty routine installation from anything that I'm seeing here. Is there anything odd about this that, in case I haven't read this close enough, that you could point out to us?
No, I believe it's pretty straightforward. The only difference than what we typically do is we typically propose a chain link fence, but the county asked us to put in the wood fence, which we have upgraded in the drawings as well to show that. So that's just one more layer of, you know, sheltering for the neighbors.
Very much. We will
Okay, thank you.
Opposed for purposes of deliberation. So first of all, we have the findings of fact. Are there any items in there that have come up as part of your review or our discussion today that would cause us to want to amend those facts?
Move to adopt the findings of fact and staff report prepared for presentation to the Board of Adjustment.
Okay. We have a motion and a second to adopt the findings of fact in the staff report prepared for and presented to the Story County Board of Adjustments. Roll, please.
McGill.
Aye.
Miller.
Aye.
Scarlett.
Aye.
Gilmeyer.
And then we go on to the decision, and this is kind of the same sort of a thing, and the decision is making sure we have all the facts on the table. And then going through the items that were in there, I think the one item, with the assumption, and I may just ask this as opposed to is going through, we first of all have got our first criteria there. Does anyone have any concerns? We do not have to approve these separately, do we? I didn't think so. So I'm hoping that we can deal with this in total. So does anybody on items A, B, and C have any concerns about those criteria? As I said, we've been through those a number of times. This appears to be fairly routine. So then we do have some supplemental, and there's one item that is, and we've already addressed the decommissioning that was brought up in here, and that would be on page 6. And I just want to bring it up because, you know, it's I don't want to call it an anomaly, but it's a, you know, something of note as to whether the board has a concern. We have that west setback, both parcels owned by the same person. It doesn't cause me, just in part of the discussion here, concern, because actually, as you talk about land development, if you were to co-join those properties, all of a sudden you have a property that can be subdivided and built on, and today we don't, with the assumption that this becomes a different sort of a property of being part of the fringe. We probably have more protections with it configured the way that it is today than we would otherwise. Does any other board member have a concern with the two parcels?
Sold that neighboring parcel. Is that grandfathered in then?
This would become a just like we talked about, a legally existing, because we would have approved it, non-conforming structure. Wouldn't change it at all other than that.
Yeah, I think the only thing that could possibly happen would be if the tower was destroyed, tornado or something like that came through, and it had to be rebuilt at that point. If that first property was sold at that point, the new tower would have to meet current regulations, so it would just have to move. I also think, yeah, you're probably thinking of something that probably will never happen, hopefully, but...
Or to a house about a half mile away.
Yeah, and I guess I shouldn't say a tornado would never happen, because we did have a tornado actually go pretty much a couple feet away from this area, I think, back in 2005, so...
Don't change your mind. Actually, your odds are in your favor at this point, so, okay.
And
one item I wanted to make sure we at least chatted about.
Yeah, and I just wanted to add on that, too. The nice thing is we do say neighboring properties, and we don't define properties, so with that, the Board of Adjustment is able to interpret what you believe property is.
Okay, we have a motion and a second to adopt the decision as outlined in the staff report prepared and presented to the Story County Board of Adjustment. Roll, please.
Gilmeyer. McGill.
Aye.
Miller.
Aye.
Scarlett.
Aye.
Move to approve the request as proposed to the applicant in case one of the CUP 08-14, as discussed by the Board of Adjustment and in staff report prepared for presenting the Story County Zoning Board of Adjustment, finding that all applicable standards and approvals have been satisfied.
Okay, we have a motion and a second to approve the request as proposed by the applicant in case number CUP 08-14, as discussed by the Board of Adjustment and the staff report prepared for and presented to the Story County Board of Adjustment, finding that all applicable standards of approval have been satisfied. Roll, please.
Scarlett.
Aye.
Gilmeyer. McGill?
Aye.
Miller?
Aye. Well, we appreciate your patience. So we come on to comments, and I guess ask for any comments from the board.
Board or staff?
I'm sorry, from staff.
No, we can go in any
order. I read too fast.
Yeah, that's not an issue. Just a few things I'll jump into real quick. And as I mentioned in the last meeting, you know, we are currently one member down on the Board of Adjustment. Vicki, your term is up, and I know you have indicated that you possibly might not be looking for a reappointment. If that is the case, we'll be two members down come the new year. I did have a conversation with one of our board members this morning regarding it, and he did have, I think, some people possibly lined up or some ideas of some people to appoint. So we might be making some traction on that, but nonetheless, if there's anybody you know out there, encourage them to apply, because the best thing in the world would be to have way too many applicants that want these positions, and we have to choose between people, because that usually isn't how it happens. I also did mention last time, too, and this is a really good example of how this meeting happened today, but maybe possibly in the future looking at changing start times to meetings. As we had mentioned in the past, it does get somewhat problematic when we have meetings after hours, just with the way this building's secured and locked, that if one person forgets to unlock the doors, we can run into a problem of having to keep doors open for people. Obviously, we'll approve, or the board will approve their schedule for 2015 within the next few months, hopefully. So just keep in mind if it's possible to maybe have an earlier starting time. I don't know how your schedules work. You're a volunteer board, so this is completely up to you. Staff will do whatever pretty much you decide is best. But looking at that, at the same time, we've also been toying around with some ideas of how we're spacing our meetings. Conditional use permits, for example, we have to take those to Planning and Zoning Commission, and then those applicants have to wait another month now to come to Board of Adjustment, because our Planning and Zoning Commission meets on our first Monday, you meet on the first Wednesday. We can't move those applications forward that fast within 2 days. So we're looking at possibly spacing the meetings a little bit differently throughout the month, so we can make our services, I guess, a little bit faster on those conditional use permits. If it would work out, possibly maybe the third Wednesday of the month instead of the first Wednesday of the month, and I don't know if that would affect anybody on the board. But just things to keep in mind, and we'll make those proposals as we get a little bit closer and have those discussions with you. With our meeting last time, we did discuss about our publications of meetings and how we're required by law to publish notice in papers no more than 4, no less than 20. The more I looked into that after that meeting, I'm not sure were the Board of Adjustments even required to publish public hearings in the paper. I would also argue that publishing public hearings in the paper is a very outdated method of reaching out to the public. We have so many other avenues between Facebook, Twitter, with our website that we can reach out to the public. I've never once heard of a person who came to a meeting that said, I read about this in the paper. It's usually with the mail that we send out and stuff like that. So we have better ways of getting to the public. So if there is a way that we can stop publishing those public hearings in the paper, I think we're going to do that, because in the end, and I'd look even to Kristen at this, I think we would probably save almost $3,000 a year just by not publishing in the paper anymore. So that's a pretty big savings for, again, something that's pretty outdated. If that is, and I have to check with our attorney's office first to make sure that they're in line with that, but if that is the case, the Board of Adjustment does have a rules of procedure. I don't know if some of you have even seen it or not, but we haven't made revisions to it since 2008, so it might be time to make some revisions to that. One thing, as I was looking at it last time, it does mention the Planning and Zoning Department throughout that. Our department has changed names, so it's just probably time to bring a change forward on that, and that'll probably be coming forward in the next few, hopefully next few meetings. Lastly, the only thing I wanted to bring up is hopefully with our work program that we'll be looking at doing here in 2015, I'm going to try to reach out to Board of Adjustment, the Planning and Zoning Commission, the Board of Supervisors to ask for anything that you've seen in our zoning regulations throughout your time on the board that you think doesn't fit, needs to be changed. And I think what I'm asking here is probably transitioning into the board comments from what Dave said earlier. But just you know, anything that you think maybe we can do some research on to see if we can make the regulations better for Story County in any way, shape, or form. So throughout this, in the next few months, if there's anything you think of, shoot me an email, whatever, bring it to the next meeting, and we'll discuss it, and we'll start making a list of possible things that we can look at, and we'll start building a work program based off the proposed changes that you may have. So those are the only comments I have. I don't know, Kristen, if you have anything that needs to be added.
I would sure encourage you to look into the public notice. I mean, for boards that don't meet on a prescribed time, I completely understand.
But if you're always going to have scheduled for whatever day of the month and all the time, $3,000 or the other
connection. That's just the publishing cost, much less the time and effort. I'd sure encourage you to check that out further.
And if we do that, we'll just have to make sure that we don't ever refer to the public components as a public hearing. We can still call them a hearing because by code, technically, that's still what they are. We just, it can't be something that we're advertising as a public hearing. We obviously would still take public comment because we'll still meet all our other regulations about notifying the public of the meeting. We'll still be sending our SPO letters. We'll still be posting signs on the larger projects. So that's not going to go away. It's just more or less getting rid of this, again, this outdated method, in my opinion.
As we look at the possibility of changing, reconfiguring times and dates and et cetera, I guess I would like to ask staff to kind of put your heads together to figure out what works for the schedule of this building and just all kinds of things to say, we're thinking that this could work or that could work, you know, with whatever three or four different options. Send that out to us electronically so we have an opportunity to kind of look not just at, you know, September, but kind of a little more globally ourselves. Rather than wait till scheduling, we've got to make a decision. For us to be able to communicate to you that, hey, Thursdays won't work for me, whatever it is, won't work for me at all, and get that all on the table early.
Mm-hmm. I don't know when our next meeting will be. I know we haven't received anything for our next meeting, so I'm pretty sure you won't be having a meeting next month. So we'll probably be pushing out past then. But, you know, as far as starting times, we're pretty open, I think. So, you know, if you want to start at 8 o'clock in the morning, we'll start at 8 o'clock in the morning. I don't know if you want to do that. That might be too much. But it really comes down to your work schedules and what's going to work.
I'm going to work by 7, so it's fine by me. I just want to say why so late.
Well, that's what it comes down to. You know, we're obviously paying our staff overtime to be at these meetings late and all that and trying to just work around schedules with everybody. But like I said, you know, just think about it, and maybe at the next meeting we'll come back with maybe some proposals of different times and look at how we can do it. As I mentioned in the last meeting, you know, the one nice thing about having the night meetings is it does open it up to the public a little more, but you've all been on this board for a while. I've been here for a while, and it really doesn't seem that we get too much public coming in to begin with. So is it worth having a night meeting to attract maybe the one or two people that come in per year? I don't know. So
night meetings too, and
yeah, and that's a good point. Yeah, when this current board started, they did try to have one. I think it was one night meeting a month, and it only lasted about 3 or 4 months, and they went away with it because it just wasn't effective.
One of the things I guess we'd also like to hear from you in this process, if we talk about efficiency of meetings and the need to meet and et cetera, is exploring that boundary for which the director, interim directors, or whatever have got the ability to approve as opposed to coming to the full board. And there's been a couple of instances where, you know, it got to a point where the applicant said, I think I want to go to the board. But if there's some latitude that we could reasonably give to the office and still meet our charge, and only you know the conversation mm-hmm. that you all are having
yeah.
in the office. We don't.
Yeah.
But if there are some that make sense that just really aren't deal breakers here, you might think about where that boundary is too, and whether between us or the Board of Supervisors we need to consider, you know, I'm looking at minor modifications there, but sometimes that can make quite a bit of difference.
We have a modification process set up for a conditional use permit where probably 50% of those come through as minor modifications, or excuse me, not minor modifications, but insignificant modifications that you're probably not made aware of, which is probably something we do need to do, is just make you aware when we do make those modifications, maybe in a report at the end of the meeting. But As far as variances, you know, the only thing I will say is that if there was no staff present, you would probably have 3 to 4 variance cases every month. And we, you know, I think on the staff level, we do a pretty good job of encouraging other remedies possibly to applicants. Some of them don't come to us at all. They just submit their variance application. Others, you know, if they feel that they can make a good argument, they want to come forward. So we allow that, obviously. But we do, you know, lay out options for people before coming to this point. So. You have to look in the legality of it. I'm not aware of any other counties that do it. Yeah, there's some special exceptions I know that you can, but I'm really familiar, obviously, with what we do here, and we've never done anything like that. I could ask around, I guess, and see what other counties do, see if there's any way that they can administratively take care of some of the minor variances. If they do, I have no idea. It'd be interesting to look into, though.
One of the things we've learned is we put this field today and to me it's a fine example of shoots that we hate. And then we expect us to get a variance because it's already there. Is there any type of public education? Quite frankly, Story County regulations are more stringent than really allowed.
That be part of, like, when you get a building permit, that piece of information could be included?
We could definitely look into that. I was going to say, we don't, you know, I know our assessor's office deals with point of sale, and they'll see with the transactions that come through on land and stuff like that. They use that for assessment purposes. We don't ever see that. We don't see deeds when they come through. We do have offices that do review deeds. We do see plaque survey when they come through, et cetera. So, you know, there's definitely things that we probably could do to maybe reach out and do it. But at the same time, you know, we have a book of regulations that's that thick, and trying to summarize every single one of those to a point where somebody will actually read through it could be difficult. But there definitely are a lot of things I think that maybe we could work on doing a little bit better.
And I've not heard this in Story County. I know of three other people that I know that have, and in other counties, have bought property with the idea they're going to just do this with it. And in each case, they couldn't. And it's kind of a buyer beware sort of thing.
Yeah.
Kind of the same thing, too, if you were in Ames. And if you had this, quote, hot idea, you're just going to buy this lot and you're going to do this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of people understand that if I'm in town, I want to do this. It somehow that does not transfer to the country. When I'm in the country, I somehow can do whatever I want to do.
Do you have like a frequently asked questions portion?
We do on our website, yeah. Yeah, and I was just looking at that this morning. I don't know. I know we have quite a few questions on there. Yeah, yeah. I don't know how often it gets used or anything like that, but yeah, you know, continuing this conversation, but, you know, I've dealt with it before where somebody buys a piece of property, their realtor said that they could build on it, they come to us, and then we're like, you know, sorry, you can't, you know, I'm sorry that, and it always ends up being us that are the bad guys throughout the entire process. It's never going to be the realtor, and that's what we deal with every day. I also am very thankful to anybody who ever calls ahead of time to ask, you know, hey, I'm looking at this property, I want to know what I can do, because those people are few and far between, but...
Yeah.
Yeah. Good. Very good. And I did it too, but just knowing the profession I'm in, it was a little bit easier for me to do it when we built our house, bought our house. But yeah, it's just one of those things. You really do need to encourage people before they make those large purchases of land for whatever purpose. Call us and ask us, because we can usually give them any information they're looking for. If not, we can do the research on it. They can pay for that research at the cost of $30 to do it. And at that point, we should be able to give them any information they want. So.
Put out some sort of brochure
We did put out a brochure. You have, Kristen put together the guide to rural living thing that we have, and I don't know if we ever did any. Yeah, I don't know if we ever did any outreach on that. If we tried to give it to libraries or realtors or anything, I don't know. But that's definitely. I mean, we could look into getting some of that information out pretty easily, I would think, because we have the information. It's just, I know we put it on our website. It's there. One of the things.
Thing about the fringe plan and what it does or doesn't do, and et cetera. I've heard questions from other homeowners, landowners, that am I in or aren't I in, and what does it really mean?
Mm-hmm.
And there's a whole FAQ there that would help a ton of people.
There is a lot of confusion out there. What we do, again, something we deal with every day, people call in and say, well, I own this lot, but I've been told I have to have 40 acres to build. And it's like, well, no, we're 35 acres, but that's dependent on the zoning district you're in. Later to find out they're in a zoning district that'll allow them to build on 1 acre, so they're fine. But you know, I heard from my neighbor who has different circumstances on their land. And
let's just encourage anybody to call and ask. Because everybody's situation could be different.
Yeah, and you'll always have people who call in and just generally, I want to know this. And no, I can't tell you a general answer because we need to know specifics for the property, because every piece of property is different and regulations change property by property. So.
Anything else from staff? Go to board comments. First of all, I'd like to publicly thank the other board members and the staff for putting together this special meeting. I mean, I know it's a stretch for everybody, but I think it was the right thing to do from a scheduling perspective and from a timeliness perspective. So I want to thank everybody for that. Second, I guess I would make a motion that as a board we direct staff to prepare a letter to go out under the board chair's signature on behalf of the board, asking. We've talked about, so the context is there. Asking that the sign ordinance be reviewed, particularly as it applies to a primary sign as opposed to a directional sign, or call it a secondary sign, I don't know the right term. So you can put it, I think staff can put it into the right terms, but just asking them to do it. I mean, it goes up there as an input from the board that we've come into a situation and we're not completely comfortable with it, and we'd ask that they review that when they have that opportunity. Well, that, I'll put that forth as a motion.
Second.
Okay. So we have a motion and a second to direct staff to draft a letter for signature to the chair on behalf of the board, asking the board of supervisors to review sign policy along the terms that we talked about during this meeting. Did you just do a roll call now?
Charlotte?
Aye.
McGill?
Aye.
Miller?
Aye.
Gilmeyer?
Aye.
Okay. We're all on the record on that.
I have to copy it. It could be sent to the gentleman who came in today.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
No problem.
And real quick on that, too, I know there's actually many components of our sign regulations that probably need to be looked at. We don't speak on temporary signs. That was one issue actually that's come up in the last couple of days with an individual. We don't say anything about temporary signs, yet we have all these temporary signs out there all the time for real estate purposes. And if you're trying to get those people to meet current sign regulations, they don't work. My thought with our sign regulations are, you know, I don't know how many of you were on the board when we dealt with the Story County Vet Clinic sign just down the road from Better Here. Yeah, and that was a very similar situation, but the situation there was we had a billboard that was 300 square feet that was on that property, but you would never know that it was on the same property. It was just how it was, and they wanted to put up that sign, so they actually had to knock square footage off that billboard to be able to put up that other sign. I think there's ways that we can look at this based off, you know, Vetter's property, for example, is a 30 or a 40 acre parcel, and we allow up to 300 square feet on that parcel. However, you go down the road and there's a 5 acre parcel that's commercial. We also allow 300 square feet on that 5 acre parcel. So the two don't really coincide with each other, you know, as far as cumulative sign area to size of the property. If there's some sort of ratio we can come up with that would allow for more signage, that might be something to look at. But those are just some ideas I have, and I'll at least write the letter how you're looking at. But I think the sign regulations are something that we do need to start looking at a little bit more holistically. So it's probably come up before. Yeah. Definitely. Definitely we'll do that because that's something that we need to look at.
Don, you're putting a sign up, and that's going to be under Nevada's jurisdiction. So if it turns out
already up.
Betters could have had or...
Oh, I noticed it was up last night, and I was really close to trying to find out some of the specifics to it prior to this meeting in case it came up, but I didn't want to.
You've got situations where people are scared to take them down because they're non-conforming, because they want to grandfather.
Especially along the interstate. All those signs that are put up along the interstate were done so way before we had sign regulations or grandfathered in. We put in a clause in our ordinance. It was probably about 5 years ago now that states that all those signs have to be structurally sound and in good shape. Otherwise, we can turn around and make them tear them down because what happened was those signs are so old and they get dilapidated and the landowner just let them go. And from the Board of Supervisors standpoint, is the interstate's kind of where everybody in the country comes through and sees Story County, so we want to look good sort of thing. But most of those signs are in good shape. It's just, you know, once they do get dilapidated, we want them taken down, so...
Anything else for the cause? Hearing none, we will stand adjourned then. Thank you very much.